Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. That is a new book by Boston Globe reporters Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy, and they are here with me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Emily.
So, Shelley, you're going to be actually going to the hearing this afternoon
yes.
at federal court. What is this one about?
Well, it's more on Whitey's immunity claim. It's really a hearing on whether or not the judge will decide his claim that he had immunity to commit crimes prior to the trial, or whether he'll be able to present that defense to a jury.
Oh, so they're going to decide whether he can actually
have evidence today. The judge is going to decide whether he'll hold a hearing on that issue pretrial, or whether or not he's just going to outright decide, okay, you can present that evidence to a jury.
All right. So we're both writing about the phone call last week that Whitey Bulger had with his brother. What was the strategy? Actually, just repeat, Kevin, if you would, what that conversation was.
Conversation last September, his brother Jack went down to visit him, as he is wont to do. Both Jack and Bill visit him very regularly. And on it, Whitey was talking about he said, I was never an informant for the. I didn't give them anything. And he accused John Conley, more or less, of making up the reports. He said, I wasn't aware he was writing this stuff down and making reports, blah, blah, blah. But, of course, first of all, I don't think Whitey does anything without, careful consideration.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't just fly off the handle and start spilling
The only caveat I would say, Emily, is that he is 83 years old. He's been locked up now since June of 2011. He's in his cell, 23 hours a day. And he gets out of his cell 5 days a week for an hour. So, could he be cracking up? I think there's a possibility. But I still think he was very consciously, he knew his conversations were being listened to.
So why would he do this? Because it sort of undermines his own.
I believe it does undermine his own claim.
The
issue is
if
they gave you immunity, what did they give it to you for?
Yeah.
The presumption would be that they gave it to you in exchange
for something.
Gave
them tips on the,
And I think a lot of this, Whitey engages in a lot of his life, you will realize he engages in semantics and sophistry.
Hmm.
And the idea, he says, I was not an informant. And I think he bases that on the thing that I never get up there and testified. I never personally put anybody in prison. That's the way he says it. So, and part of it, I have always said it was something of a scam. The idea the FBI and John Conley would hold Whitey up there as this font of information about the mafia was ludicrous. He didn't have that kind of information about the mafia. So they always overstated his importance, but he's claiming there was no importance. He gave them nothing.
Shelley and Kevin, when you set out to, I read as much as I possibly could because I just got the book this morning, but you want to have a timeline here. You're trying to set the record straight, sort of devoid of any, let's say, personal interest. Because there's been a ton of books written, as mm-hmm. you know, and some of them were, at least handled by people who were intimately involved in some of the crimes themselves. So what was your mission here?
Well, our mission was to really tell an accurate story, to dig up as much information as we possibly could to give people a complete picture of what Whitey was like. How did he, what was he like as a young man? How did he rise to power? What did he do while he was, in charge of the rackets in South Boston and beyond? And then, turn to how he was caught, his years on the run. And the idea was to try to paint a picture of him, a complete picture that was very, fair and balanced and informative.
And one difference about this, Emily, is there have been probably too many books written about Whitey Bulger. This is the first book in which it's not just us telling you what we think about Whitey Bulger. We have a lot of Whitey Bulger's own views of himself, and it's a very high view of himself.
Yes, yeah.
And this is obviously based on the letters of his friend Richard Sunday, which he's been sending, this sort of prison correspondence since he was locked up. And it's very revealing. I'm not saying it's true, but I think for example, the dramatic thing of him claiming he would give his life up for the woman he loves, Kathy Gregg, his companion on the run. Yeah, he said that he offered himself up for execution in Florida and Oklahoma if they'd let her go. Well, that's fine. It's very romantic, and it's very.
To let her go when? Now?
When she was facing charges for harboring him.
Oh.
So what he was off, but here's my point on this. It could have been a lot easier. Instead of offering his life for execution, he should have told his lawyer to tell her lawyer, give me up. Tell them whatever they need to say. Cooperate with the government in exchange for not going to jail. And that would have worked.
Hmm.
But instead, he puts out this dramatic story, this noble, romantic that he would give his life for the woman he loved.
To put it mildly, Whitey Bulger doesn't like you too. he didn't want to cooperate. I mean, did you both write him letters? What kind of correspondence did you do? What kind of communications all have you had with him?
We wrote to him repeatedly over the course of since his arrest, saying we're writing a book, would like your input. And we never heard back from him. And he did write to this friend who did speak with us, a guy who served time with Whitey in Alcatraz and has been corresponding with him since he's been in Plymouth Jail, told us that,
you could communicate with ex-cons if you're in jail. I guess you can.
No, you can. You can exchange letters.
Yeah, but he said he really despises all of the media, the Globe in particular.
And why? Does he think that you have a particular vendetta?
Well, no, I think that he wants to make money off of his story. He's kind of embraced his own celebrity since he's been in jail. Like we saw in one of the letters, he actually signed it Whitey and said, you might be able to make some money selling my autograph. He's boasted about how when people go to Alcatraz now, where Whitey had served time in the late 50s and early 60s, they're not really asking about Al Capone as much as they're asking about Whitey Bulger. He's saying, you can make money. You know, I could make money off of this story. He's talking about, telling a story in a way that he doesn't want anyone else to profit from it.
But the animosity towards the Globe is special and distinct. And you have to remember, first of all, we have a whole chapter about the busing, a lot of new information about what he was doing during busing. He hated, like a lot of people in Southie, he hated the Globe, saw the Globe as being very unfair to South Boston, as demonizing people from Southie as racist and racist only for their opposition to busing. Now, obviously, that's one part of it. The other part of it is he hated the Globe because he perceived the Globe as being very negative toward his brother in all sorts of reporting. And let's not forget, in 1988, the Globe exposed Whitey Bulger as an FBI informant, which kind of changed the narrative and basically began the clock ticking on how long he could survive, literally survive. I mean, one of the things we have in the book is it's unbelievable to me that he was out there on the street for 6 years after we made that claim. Well, not that claim. We said he has a relationship with the FBI. And nobody in organized crime made a move towards him. And as we have in the book, when Tony Cardinale, who's represented a lot of mafia guys, actually asked three separate mafia leaders, Jerry Angiulo here, Fat Tony Salerno in New York, and John Gotti, why didn't you guys know this guy was an informant? Why didn't you do anything about it? They all replied in separate conversations similarly. They did not believe the FBI would get in bed with a guy like Whitey Bulger. So the mafia had more confidence in the FBI than the FBI deserved.
So, I mean, what kind of stuff was Whitey Bulger given to the FBI? I mean, we all know about the infamous bugging of the garage and taking, but was he all that instrumental in bringing down the mafia, the Irish mob? Italian mob?
No, I don't think he was instrumental in bringing down the mafia. I think that, there were a lot of informants. You know, if you look at the record that's been, put into evidence in various proceedings in court, really, Stevie Flemmy was the guy.
Yeah.
And Stevie Flemmy was Whitey's partner, and Whitey basically rode Stevie Flemmy's coattails. And I think from Whitey's perspective, his deal with the FBI was great for him. I mean, because he was getting credit for information that Flemmy was really passing along. I mean, his own crimes were being ignored. And it's clear that he had permission to be involved in gambling and loan sharking.
Yeah. Ostensibly, you could make a case in 1975 when John Connally recruited him as an informant that was a legitimate act by an FBI agent to gain intelligence. What I've always argued is that as soon as the Angiulo crime family, the mafia faction, was taken off the streets in 1983, they should have closed them out. Now, they also should have closed them out because he was implicated in four murders in 1982 and 1983. That's a whole separate issue. But in terms of him being an asset, an intelligence asset, that was gone. By 1983, he and Steve Flemmy were the most powerful gangsters beyond any dispute in the city of Boston. And the idea that they were protected informants from the FBI is scandalous, outrageous, and they could never defend that.
Yeah, but it's very interesting because it was pretty smart on Whitey's part. I mean, the FBI, if there was a crime, a major crime in the city, they would go to, like, the Garden Museum heist or the Depositors Trust Bank in Medford that was robbed. They would go to him and say, hey, what do you know about this? And then he would you know, use what knowledge he was getting from the FBI to go out and extort people and get a little piece of what, you know, was stolen.
Take me back to Whitey's beginnings and his friendship with John Connolly and how that got going. I love your little maps, by the way, in the book about who lived where and where the bodies are buried and all that. But, you know,
small
you look
world
at the,
over there.
It's a small world.
And
so
they were, I mean, he was a
child
of the Depression, a child of the New Deal. Whitey Bulger was born in Everett, wasn't even born in Boston. The only reason his family lived in Dorchester for a while. The mother was from Charlestown. The father, I think, spent a lot of his formative years on the North End.
What did the father do?
The father was a laborer, which was difficult because he lost his arm as a young man in a railroad accident. And back then, there wasn't really a market for one-armed laborers.
sure.
And there was also no welfare net back there.
They were
there,
poor. So they were very poor.
Yeah. And, I mean, the family only moved to South Boston because there was a young and upcoming congressman named John McCormick who would later become majority leader and then also Speaker of the House. And John McCormick prevailed upon Franklin Delano Roosevelt to build the first housing project in South Boston, which is where the Bulger family moved when it opened in 1938. And there's quite a gap between Connolly and Bulger. They weren't friends. There was too far. But Bulger, Bulger was the young hood, the tough guy in the project that everybody knew. And they actually, I mean, Shelley interviewed John Connolly. I'll let her take it over here because it's
so
a wonderful
story.
And so
did you, Emily. I know you did, yeah.
The way they actually met is when John was, I think, 8 years old was when they first met.
Well, I mean, Whitey just knew him as this guy that everybody, he was sort of a legend in the projects, but the one who was really a mentor to John Connolly was Billy Bulger. I mean, John said credits Billy with telling him, you know, you should study and that education was the key to, you know, advancement and, you know, encouraged him to join the FBI. And they had worked together as lifeguards. So when John recruited Whitey as an informant, it was because, you know, the mafia at that point was the number one target of the FBI. And really, you know, John appealed to Whitey saying, look, you know, you can't trust the mafia. They'll try to take you out. We hear there's some friction right now over placement of vending machines around the city, you know, and, yeah. And here's your opportunity. You know, he could plant a gun in a car and, you know, I mean, Jerry Angiulo had all these connections within the police department, you know, corrupt connections, and that John appealed to him, Whitey, and said, if you help us, you know, we can help you. And I think that the key was that Whitey probably wouldn't have trusted anybody else, but he trusted John because he was a Southie guy. He was a neighborhood guy. And John says that he told Whitey, you know, I won't ever hurt you. Yeah. And I think that's...
We actually devote a lot of time in the book to that Irish-Italian divide, which I think a lot of newcomers to Boston wouldn't appreciate.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was very, very intense. And obviously when you expand it out to the criminal milieu, that it was deadly. And so
a lot of animosity towards the Italian neighborhood.
And like I said, Whitey would have grown up in this culture in which the prevailing current, the wisdom was that when the Irish left South Boston and went for a big sit down with the Italians in the North End, the Gustin Gang, when they did that during Prohibition, the Italians killed them. And that you could never trust the Italians and whatever. There was an uneasy relationship between the mafia and the Irish mob in this town. And they would work together when there was mutual interest, but they often, you know, were engaged. And then obviously there was the Irish gang war in the 60s, which Whitey's great fortune then was that he was locked up. Because there would have been a strong chance that he would have been either a victim or a perpetrator. Mm. So if you look at Whitey's life, he benefits from timing. Timing is everything in all facets of life, as it was for a guy like Whitey.
Talking to Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy, who have a new book out, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. Well, how did Whitey Bulger end up going on such a divergent track from William and, frankly, his other brothers?
Well, I mean, that's a really great question because when you look through Whitey's prison file, which I did, and you know, when he was in Alcatraz and he was writing letters to his family and to priests, we've seen some of that correspondence where he talks about, you know, I'm going to get out, I'm going to go straight, I'm going to work hard, and the Billy is very supportive and trying to help him, and Whitey says, you know, I really want to do well by my family, and it looked like when he got out, he certainly convinced Father Drinan his mentor, that when he got out, he was going to do really well for himself. But I think what happened is he hit the streets and he had a legitimate job at the courthouse, And I don't think Whitey was cut out for a 9-to-5 job.
Plus, he wanted to make some money.
He wanted money. And I think that's what it was all about. It was making money. And it was a time when there was a lot of, it's hard to pull yourself out of that life. He was part of that life before he went in. And I think he very quickly gravitated back into that.
I think obviously he as a criminal is at a whole different level, a whole different echelon. But I don't think it's that unusual at that time, at that place, that the same household could produce very, gifted, accomplished children, and then somebody who went down the other road. I mean, you just have to go across Old Colony Boulevard to the other side of the other project and go into Kevin Weeks's houses. Kevin was his protege, Whitey's protege. You know, Kevin Weeks could have gone to Harvard because his two brothers did. They came out of the project. Billy Weeks and Jack Weeks went to Harvard, became very successful guys, tried to get Kevin into Harvard too. And so it wasn't that unusual to me. And I know so many families in South Boston because my entire maternal side is from there. And I know so many families that the kids grew up in good, loving families, and some of the kids turned out great. Other kids went down another road.
And I think one other point is that Whitey certainly was very smart. And I think that once he decided he was going down that road, he wasn't going to just be a gangster. He was going to be the best one. He was going to be the top dog. He wasn't planning on taking orders from anybody.
So did he have money? And where did that $868,000 come from that was found in the walls of that Santa Monica apartment? I mean, did he have money?
Yeah, well, one thing we established beyond any reasonable doubt in the book is that Whitey made the bulk of his money, the big, big money that fueled the 16 years on the run by shaking down drug dealers, by getting a kind of... Now, he obviously, when in the 70s and 80s, he was making money shaking down bookies. But you know what? The state of Massachusetts became the biggest bookie in the state. And the idea that you could make a good living shaking down bookies back in the 70s, but the real money was in drugs. And when he got his hooks into a guy like Joe Murray in the early 80s, that's when he started really making money.
What did he offer in return? Actually, that's the funny thing about Whitey.
He offered nothing.
The line was, you know, you can buy your life. I'll let you buy your life. You know, you can pay me.
And I won't kill you.
Yeah.
But, that's the other thing. Bookies complained about that Whitey and Stevie would take money off them. But they didn't do anything
for
him.
But how did he move the money around? I mean, how did he move the money even that he was found with in the end?
Well, he had money stashed over. You have to remember, and it's detailed in the book, that he spent the last few years before he took off preparing to take off. He had money in Dublin. He had money in London. He had money in Florida. He was safe deposit boxes.
Absolutely.
So he actually went to all those places.
Absolutely.
And he
obviously went there very often with Teresa Stanley's paramour on vacation, he would call it, or whatever. But he had an ulterior motive, and that was to stash money, and because he knew the day of reckoning was coming. So if in fact, after 16 years on the run with no visible means of support and money not coming in, the fact that he had, after all those years, $800,000 in his wall in Santa Monica, you can only imagine, Emily, how much money he had out there all those years.
And frankly, have they found all the money?
Probably not, I think that's doubtful.
No, and one of the things that prosecutors said in filings is that he stashed money with trusted friends, and those people haven't been identified. And that's something that, Whitey says Kathy Gregg doesn't know anything. She can't help the government. But maybe she does know where money is hidden. That's what I think what the judge said when he sentenced her is, if you want to come back and tell us a little bit more that we don't know, maybe, you'll get leniency.
I used to joke over the years, give me $500,000 and I'll find this guy. How hard was it? I mean, it turns out he was living in plain sight. He wasn't overseas, as everybody had projected. Why was this so hard?
I think, as we tried to recount in the book, the first 2 years were the years they really could have got him. And the task force from the beginning, I had argued that it was a conflict of interest. You had the FBI, not only the FBI, but the organized crime squad, which was implicated in all his dealings. They were supposedly in charge of finding him. And what was their incentive exactly to bring him in? The reality is that those first 2 years when they established their permanent residence out in Santa Monica, those were the years they should have been caught. But there was just an inherent conflict of interest. You will never convince me that those guys, the first 2 years in the FBI, wanted to find Whitey. I don't believe it for a minute. They did not want to bring
now,
him
in. There was not a task force created, a multi-agency task force. The FBI, you know, called in other agencies in 1997 after the revelation in court that he was an FBI informant, and there was huge public pressure to find him. And I think at that point, there was a sincere effort to find him. I mean, I think that they were chasing tips all over the place. And at that point, Whitey had abandoned the IDs they knew about. He had settled in Santa Monica, and and he looks like everybody. Our grandparents. I mean,
of the 800,000 homeless people who stroll around that area.
And it's stunning to me that Santa Monica. I mean, there are so many people from Boston out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of our reporters, his brother lived a couple of blocks from.
Yeah, but with the beard and everything, nobody would have recognized.
We found is that he didn't go out much. Yeah. He really was sort of a semi-recluse. I think he was very conscious that. You know, there was a bar a couple of blocks from his place that's a Boston sports bar. Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't go into it. There were claims after he was captured that he used to go there. That's baloney.
But I think also that, let's face it, if you're on the 10 most wanted list, most of us, your perception of someone is they look scary. They look dangerous. They look like a fugitive. He didn't look like that. He looked very grandfatherly. Mm-hmm. He passed himself off as this, retiree. And the fact that she was so nice. Kathy was so nice and so friendly, and people genuinely liked her, that she certainly helped him not arouse suspicion.
Okay, so when the FBI did that public service announcement, the campaign, and, they aged Whitey and Catherine Gregg and did all that, a lot of people thought it was a ruse and that, that this was just...
I was very skeptical.
Yeah, I know.
You know that.
I think we were talking to you that it wasn't real and that... They had him in the back pocket all along, and then it just happened so quickly. Nobody believed the story of the woman from Iceland, but it turned out to be
true. It seemed so too pat, but Shelley found the woman from Iceland.
I know, that was amazing. Tell that story. How'd you find her?
Well, I went out and interviewed neighbors, and word had leaked out that I think it was WBUR that first reported that the tip had come from Iceland. And I went out and interviewed a lot of neighbors in their neighborhood and asked, well, who around here is from Iceland? And I found out that there was this woman, Anna Bjornsdóttir, former Miss Iceland, who lived in that neighborhood for months at a time, and that she had become very friendly, with Whitey and Kathy. Well, Kathy really through this cat, that she was so impressed by the fact that they took care of this stray cat. That's what, made them strike up this friendship. So I did go to Iceland and try to talk to her. I tracked her down. She wouldn't talk.
She wouldn't talk to
you. She wouldn't talk.
Was she scared?
She was scared. And I found out later that NBC had been out there before I was, knocking on her door, although they hadn't reported it. But her name was around. People had figured out, I think, who she was. And I was able to confirm that she was, in fact, the tipster, that she did get $2 million for calling in the tip.
When was the last time she had seen them?
It had been some months. She actually, for a while had a place right across the street from them and then a couple of blocks away. So it had been a while. But she, she also, when she called in the tip, everything that she said sort of fit. She said that she was 100% sure that it was them, that Kathy was very nice, who she knew as Carol Gasco, and that he was kind of nasty. And I think that they had some words, and she remembered them. Hmm. And frankly, when I saw Kathy in court, I thought, well, she looks exactly like the posters they had put out. Whitey, not so much, a little harder to, distinguish, but she looked. You looked at that photo and you would, if you knew her, you would recognize her.
One of the great lines in the book is a line from Whitey, which we got from his letter to his friend, as he said, a cat got me captured.
Oh,
and the other thing we learned from the letters is that, we had known that when they had this ruse to get him down to the garage of his apartment complex in Santa Monica. They said
his locker had been broken into or something.
Right, and he came down to the garage, and we knew that they had surrounded him and told him, get down on your knees, and we knew he didn't. And it had been sort of unclear to us, well, was he able to? Was he older? Or was he struggling to get down? Or was he being belligerent or what? And what he did right since he's been in jail is that he didn't want to get his pants dirty, that there were oil stains on the garage floor, and that's why he didn't nail down.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Talking to Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy, their new book is Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. Have you spoken to former FBI agent John Connolly since he's been in jail in Florida?
Well, we saw him during his trial. I did an interview.
Yeah. I did a lengthy
but
interview.
But since then?
Yeah, after he was convicted in Florida, I did. I had an interview with him in the jail in Florida, and he still maintains his innocence.
Yeah, I just got a long, long letter from him. eight handwritten pages.
Well, I think it's interesting.
Borderline incomprehensible.
But he really thought that Whitey was going to vindicate him. Yeah. And I think it's interesting.
Not going to.
No, because as we've just seen from that letter, I mean, the conversation with his brother in the jail is that he's saying he paid FBI agents off and that he was very upset with Connolly for memorializing all of their contacts in writing.
He buried John Connolly
with
that
statement. Yeah, I don't
understand
that. He threw him under the bus. And,
and all these particularly former FBI agents who are really, you know, there's a big crowd of them who believe that John Connolly's been unfairly convicted. They all believe that Whitey was going to help get him out of jail. And that statement buried him because it implied he took money. And it explicitly says he made up reports.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a lot of sympathy for John, even among people who might think he crossed the line, he did things that were wrong, he deserved to go to prison. Even among that group, I think there are people who feel, but why is he the only one?
He took the hit for the entire department.
And you have judges who are saying that the FBI was liable. We've certainly seen evidence that higher-ups knew what was going on. They knew Whitey and Steve Fleming were suspects in several murders.
They sanctioned it. They endorsed it. They told John Conlin wasn't in charge.
And they've never – and nobody else has ever gone to, you know, prison for this.
Some of them are dead.
And here he is serving 40 years.
This is the part that's always bothered me, Emily, that John Conlin was actually – the model FBI agent. He did exactly what they told him to do, and he followed everything that the incentives created by the FBI, because FBI agents are rewarded for not for making cases, but for turning informants. And he did that as well, if not better than anyone. I would never defend what he did, the things that he's been convicted of, but I do have a real sympathy for John because I think the FBI used him. And I think the FBI and the Justice Department in cahoots with the FBI has created this false, phony narrative that one corrupt agent with one corrupt supervisor named John Morris pulled this off. It's baloney. And if you read the book, we have names in there. There were people at headquarters who looked the other way when they knew that Whitey and Stevie were implicated in murders.
And they did more than look the other way. I mean, they withheld evidence when the FBI in Tulsa was trying to investigate the murder of Roger Wheeler. They wouldn't share information.
Well, you remind me when I had that interview with John Connolly, which was 1998. I remember I gave him the whole half hour on Greater Boston. One of the questions I asked him is, well, did you ever ask Whitey or Stevie Fleming if they had killed anyone? He says, no. He said, no. Now, why would I do that? They were part of the organized crime task force, the higher echelon. What's that word he kept
top
using?
Echelon.
Top echelon. You know, it's like,
we knew they were killers, he said.
Yeah, we knew. Yeah.
And he said, we traded in, you know, so many for so many that... and that was the mentality within the Justice Department and within the U.S. Attorney's Office is that, we're targeting the mafia. We don't care about Whitey. He's just a local hoodlum. That's up to the locals to go after him. But, of course, they were undermining. There were, you know, investigations underway by DEA and Boston Police and State Police were routinely compromised.
I mean, he might have been out on the charges that he harbored a fugitive or he tipped off Whitey Bulger, but it was this murder charge that's really brought him down.
Here's the irony. The irony, Tom Foley, the state cop who eventually did lead the case against Whitey, he remarked, I remember when I called him, when Shelley and I were down in Miami when John Conley was convicted of murder, I called Tommy, just to let him know, frankly, and then to interview him for a column. He said he was sitting there. He goes, you know what's unbelievable? He said, if John Conley never tipped off Whitey to take off, that indictment that we brought down was basically shaking down bookies. Even if they were convicted, Whitey and Stevie might have done, I don't know, he said, 7-8 years. They all would have been out. We never would have found the bodies. But he said that's what changed everything when he tipped Whitey off and Whitey took off. And that's the other thing, you know. And all the people, when you go through this whole series, the only guy that was the wise guys call a stand-up guy was John Conley. And he's the one that's probably going to die in prison. And now I think Whitey will die in prison also.
And it all comes down to loyalty, really. I mean, the loyalty is the theme that runs through all of this.
Throughout the whole theme.
It's fascinating book.
And Whitey was loyal to only one person, himself.
Yeah. All right, Kevin Cullen, Shelley Murphy, new book is Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
All right, thanks. I just said that. And Callie Crossey is supposed to be here. I know she was just flying in from Atlanta or someplace and wheeling in here, but she'll be here any second.
There she is.
All right, yeah, there she is. Hey.
Hey.
You're just back.
I'm just back. and I'm here to talk about money.
Oh, cool.
You've seen those ads on TV for reverse mortgages?
Yeah, I don't understand why anybody still does that.
Well, you know, they make it sound like it's a good deal, but our Cheryl Marshall is here to say, not so much.
No, don't do it. All right. I'm Emily Rooney.
And I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.